I'd like to bring the meeting back to order. In the commissioner's absence, I'd like to turn this over to Katie Anthes and company, please. Talk to us about educator effectiveness metrics.
Yes, thank you, Madam Vice Chair, members of the board. I appreciate being here. I'm here in one of my three roles. today I'm here as the Executive Director for Educator Effectiveness. And we wanted to provide an update for you on something we like to call the Educator Effectiveness Metrics. So today is an informational item only, and it's to provide the board with the requested information on the implementation of evaluation systems specifically related to the public reporting of educator evaluation metrics. So a couple months ago I was here before you just giving you a general update on Senate Bill 191 implementation. This goes one level deeper. We didn't have a lot of time to dig into all the details in that presentation. And so we're going to give you a few more specifics here on the educator evaluation metrics. So today we're going to just give an overview again, refresher on the core purpose, components, and structure of educator evaluation systems, because that'll help you understand the metrics a little bit better. Review the purpose and requirements of publicly reporting educator effectiveness metrics. We're going to review a couple of the metrics so you get a sense of what those look like. And then we want to answer any questions you have and gather feedback and share next steps. I do want to introduce my colleague, Dr. Britt Wilkenfeld. She's next to me. She is our resident data research guru on educator effectiveness. And as soon as we get into the metrics, I become obsolete. and I need to have Britt here as my phone-a-friend at all times. So thank you.
Welcome, Britt.
I do want to just let you know and set the stage for this that this part of the reason we're bringing this before to you is there is quite a bit of anxiety in the field about this. So I think some of you, I know Board Member Rankin visited or was a part of a public meeting we had up on the Western Slopes where Britt did a presentation on the metrics. Part of our rollout for these metrics is to make superintendents aware of this, to get feedback from them, to let them know what's coming. And so Britt and her team and my team were kind of on a roadshow for quite a few months, going to all the different superintendent meetings, sharing this, a very similar presentation we're about to share with you. The result of that was a lot of anxiety from superintendents and districts around the public part, the public reporting of these metrics. And so, you know, just keep that in mind as you're listening. And toward the end of the presentation, we'll give you some of that feedback that we've been hearing. And then we want your feedback to help us craft how we want to move forward. Okay, so as a quick refresher, this was actually mostly for Commissioner Crandall, Senate Bill 191 did establish statewide quality standards for teachers, principals, and specialized service professionals. So the metrics you're going to hear about are sort of the metrics measuring those standards. The 191 also required annual evaluations for all of these professionals. And the evaluation system is really meant to do a few things. First and foremost, we like to talk about it. The purpose is to provide meaningful feedback for educators to help them get better at their craft and help them get better at their practice. And also, the purpose of the system is to provide information for districts to be used as a basis for making decisions around hiring, hiring educators, compensation for educators, assignment, professional development, a whole host of things, including whether educators have non-probationary status or whether they don't, and also non-renewal of contract. So an important thing to note at this is the only thing required in law in terms of all of those pieces that I just mentioned is that if an educator, if a teacher receives an ineffective rating for two consecutive years, they would lose non-probationary status. They can gain that status back if they earn effective or higher for 3 consecutive years. So all of those other pieces I mentioned, hiring, compensation, all of those things are at the discretion of the district. So this is the illustration of this that you've seen many times before, but the basic structure of evaluation. 50% of the evaluation rating is based on professional practice. That's what you're seeing in the classroom on a day-to-day basis, how teachers teach, what they're doing. That's most often measured by using a rubric, and you'll see the little fly out there that is quality standards 1 through 5 in our system. The other half is 50% based on student academic growth. That is, that part of the pie chart is based on multiple measures as well that districts have the authority to select. There are some guideposts around that, around what types of things they need to select, but that does comprise the other half of the system. So before we move on to the discussion of metrics, I just want to remind you all of the timeline. So I often say before you, boy, we feel like we've been talking about this for 5 years, because we have. But remember that the statewide implementation of it, actually this year that we are currently in is the first year of the complete implementation. Because last year was supposed to be the first full year, but the legislature passed some additional flexibility for districts around the measures of student learning component. So districts were able to select last year if they used measures of student learning at all. So some of our districts selected 0% for measures of student learning last year. Some continued to select 50%, but it was a district decision last year. So this year that we are currently in is actually the first year of full implementation of the entire educator effectiveness system. So what are these things called educator effectiveness metrics? These are a series of data and reports that help us and districts, by the way, review and monitor the implementation of new evaluation systems. So the purpose of those metrics are several-fold. One, to provide districts with information to help inform their continuous improvement of the system. Two, to allow CDE to identify and support districts whose metrics might identify a specific need for professional development around the implementation of evaluation systems. And then lastly, to fulfill CDE's monitoring requirements set forth in statute and rule. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So, 2 pieces. I know you all are always interested in sort of the authority for this work. And so the first part of this is the statutory reference around our reporting requirements and monitoring requirements. This is basically a quote from 22-9106 that talks about the department may solicit and collect data related to performance evaluation systems for review by the department, and we shall monitor school districts and boards of cooperative services implementation of the requirements of evaluation systems. Now you'll note that's pretty broad. That doesn't give a lot of specificity. But that same statute also grants you all the authority to promulgate rules around the reporting and monitoring of evaluation systems. So the specificity comes in your rules. And you actually have a copy of the excerpt of that rules in your packet. It looks like this. It's just a few pages. And this is just an excerpt of your full Senate Bill 191 rules. It's the full set of rules are about 50 pages. This is just the part on public reporting that we pulled out for you. So I'm going to summarize what this, 3 pages is, which it talks about, your rules talk about CDE shall report in 3 major categories. And when I say report, the way it's written in the rules right now is it publicly report. So up on our school view portal, publicly report this information. It talks about it in 3 major categories. The first category is how the data is looking in terms of the increases of effectiveness of educators statewide, what the correlations between educators' performance evaluation ratings and student performance outcomes are, and the equitable distribution of effective and highly effective teachers. So those are the three broad categories that are outlined in the rules. Under those three broad categories, are shalls. We shall do that. Underneath each of those categories, there are mays, which is the department may look at that by doing X, Y, or Z. So that's going to be an important distinction a little bit later. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to our data and research guru, Britt Wilkenfeld, to walk you through the details of the metrics.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
On page 6, reporting requirements, it says the third thing, the third bullet point says the equitable distribution of effective. And does that just mean reporting of how many effective, highly effective? Is that all that means? Well, I wasn't sure if equitable meant something.
Right. Sure. Mr. Chair. I don't know.
Yes,
Mr.
Please.
Chair,
proceed.
Thank you. So we have interpreted equitable distribution to mean that students have equal access to highly effective teachers. Not that, not about the distributions themselves. And there are, it might be in the, if you can find the section in that document.
It's under 6.04C3, page 2 of the rules. Gives you a little more detail.
So, yeah, so 6.04C3A, the number of educators assigned to each performance evaluation rating, which does get to your point, but then disaggregated by certain things such as educator demographics, student demographics, and school demographics. So it's the distributions, but then the distribution's broken down different ways. And actually, we're going to we'll go through a metric that taps into that. Thank you for your question.
Yes, Dr. Flores?
Well, if we're going to go really on research, you know, that's extant, shouldn't we really go to it and see the amount that is really related to teacher efficacy and school efficacy as far as what the research says? And the research really states that, and this is a... meta-analysis that was done on the research. It's only 7% to 20% at the most. If you aggregate teacher and all school of all school forces that really can be related to what's done or what can be measured. That's all schools and teachers can do. It's 20%. There's also all that, the family and outside forces. So how can you put 50%? I'm sorry to belabor this, but I've just gone through the research. Mm-hmm. And when we put 50% on testing, on teachers, when the research really says you can't do more than 7 for teachers, and if you put teachers and all the forces in public schools together, it's only 20%. How can you make it 50 when it's only 20?
Dr. Flores, thank you for your question. There is a lot of discussion and debate about that. Right now, what we are doing in terms of our metrics and reporting are what's based on law. So the law has articulated that 50% is based on measures of student learning and 50% are based on professional practice.
I have a corollary question.
Go ahead and follow up, Dr. Ford.
Okay, and my question is, so I know that this body also comes together and gives Jennifer ideas about a law that should be passed over across the street, and we should give them the correct research, and they should be aware that it's not 50%. So we have to be honest about what the research says and what can be what teachers are liable for. And by liable, I mean for the amount in the research. And 50% is not, it's just not, it's not right. And I think that we should ask somebody in there to run a bill right now to ask for that, to drop it to that percent. I know that some districts were given the authority to do it at what level they wanted to put that on.
Last year only.
Only, okay. So this coming year, goes
back to 50%. Correct.
Back to 50%. And that just doesn't seem fair. We need to get it at what we know, the research that's available, extant, and at the level that's available. If more research comes out that's more, which I doubt, then that should be the case. But 50% is outlandish.
Thank you.
Can we get through this by any chance?
Yeah. Oh, all right. Sorry. Okay. So since, again, my name is Britt Wilkenfeld, I'm the Assistant Director of Research on the Educator Effectiveness Team, and I work a lot with the Educator Effectiveness Metrics, so I'm going to, Dr. Anthes shared a lot of the high-level stuff, I'm going to kind of dig into some of the meat of what we've been doing. So we did start rolling the metrics out to superintendents and BOCES directors in the fall. So that we asked to attend all of the SAC meetings in the state, and we're invited to attend most of them. Representative Rankin was there for our very first one and knows how exciting it was. And along with those meetings, we also sent out a semi-private link directly to superintendents and BOCES directors that gave them access to their metrics in SchoolView. It is, however, a semi-private link because it gives them access to their data as well as other districts' data. So we are now giving them time to get used to the metrics, provide a lot of feedback, which we have received, which I will share with you later. I know that you have also received feedback as well. So we're trying to collect that a little bit systematically, so I'll tell you a little bit more about that. And in terms of the public release, the initial plan was to roll out in mid-2016, kind of give the superintendents, you know, 6 months or so with the metrics. We heard early on and quite loud that did not feel like enough time. It didn't feel like enough time to understand the metrics, to dig into the data, to kind of check into their data. I validate all of the data every year, but I don't know all of the nuance of every single district and every single school, so we also have to rely on the district to do a little bit of digging in. So they felt like that wasn't quite enough time. So we are trying to think about what timeline feels better but also seems reasonable, particularly given that State Board of Education rules state that public reporting was supposed to start in September of 2015. We do, however, feel like we're kind of on the path to meet public reporting. We felt like a good first step was reporting to superintendents, and we can make incremental steps in that. So we're going to go through a few sample metrics to give you an idea of what information is presented. We're not going to dig into some like the real technical aspects. We could sometime if you want to have a really fun conversation. I also have a lot of technical documentation that I could share if you guys are interested. I'm going to show you three different metrics. These are actual screenshots from SchoolView. So this is what superintendents see. It's what they saw in the presentations, and now they can see live on their computers. The examples focus on teacher effectiveness ratings, though we do have the same metrics basically for principals. And we're looking at real teacher evaluation ratings from the 2013-14 school year. We're looking at 2013-14 data because districts submit evaluation ratings to CDE on a one-year lag. So for instance, right now, evaluation ratings from the 2014-15 school year are being submitted. So they're being submitted right now, so that's why kind of the lag in the data reporting.
I'm sorry, for the 14-15 year being submitted now?
Right, because they're submitted through the HR collection.
Okay.
So here we're looking at distributions of teacher effectiveness ratings for novice and experienced teachers. So kind of the most basic or fundamental metric that we could look at are the distributions of ratings, right? So the percent of educators who receive a partially effective rating, the percent who receive an effective rating. What we've done here is just look at the distribution separately for novice versus experienced teachers. And if you look at the graph there, you can see down in the bottom left corner where it says novice versus experienced. The default, actually, when you go to this metric is that it says all teachers. But then you can click on it and just look at novice, or you can click on it to look at novice versus experience. We're just trying to get to a little bit more of the nuance of the data, and I just want you guys to know that for each metric, there are ways to dig in a little bit differently.
Let me ask a quick question. Yeah. You say this is an actual screenshot showing mm-hmm. actual results.
Yes.
So we have a circumstance where no teachers were labeled as ineffective.
So the group is quite small. We have, to protect educator confidentiality, even at the state level, if the group has fewer than five educators in it, we won't display the data. And that's the case there. So there are some educators, but it is a very small proportion.
And how many educators are included in the total of this effectiveness rate in the screenshot, do you know?
It's all educators in the state. I don't know the number of educators off the top of my head. I apologize. Thousands and thousands
less
and thousands.
37,000.
37,000. This is a state graph. Thank you for clarifying that.
So, fewer than 5 out of 37,000.
Mr. Chair, just for one clarification, partially effective, the way the rating system works, partially effective is also, below effective
right.
in term of that.
So it's
in terms of the consequences, but you are correct. It's the distribution is not.
Not available.
As distributed.
Right. You recognize that.
Right.
Okay. Right. You can become a researcher.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have plenty of work. Okay. All right, so here we're looking at the distributions of teacher effectiveness ratings within each SPF plan type. So SPF is the School Performance Framework, which is Colorado's accountability framework for evaluating schools. So in this graph, we've kind of turned the distributions from the previous metrics on their head, right? So each bar has kind of a histogram in it, and so then you can see the percent of educators within each performance category within each SPF plan type. So that's what we're looking at here. And this is one of the ways that we can look at the relationship between educator performance ratings and student performance, which you may recall is one of our SHAL reporting categories per state board rule.
So are you saying that this kind of reporting would meet that requirement?
Yes.
Okay.
Based on our expert interpretation. Now, so to add to that, here we actually have another way to look at the relationship between teacher effectiveness ratings and student outcomes. So here we're still looking at teacher effectiveness, and we're still looking at the school performance framework. But the difference is, in the previous metric, we were looking at the categories. Every single category, every single teacher was represented. Here, we've changed the scale, so we're looking at the percent of effective or higher teachers. Okay, so we're isolating it to effective teachers. And again, instead of the SPF categories, we're looking at the percent of points earned on the SPF. So we feel like it meets a similar reporting category. However, it gives different information. And we've done it differently. So for instance, now we have a scatter plot instead of the stacked bar graph. People are more familiar with scatter plots typically, and they're a little more intuitive, so they find this easier to read. But that is something that we do want to note. This is another way to look at the relationship between teacher ratings and student outcomes.
So explain what that graph says, please.
Yeah. Overall?
Yeah.
So overall, we're looking at the relationship between the percent of effective or higher teachers and the percent of points earned on SPF. We tend to have a positive relationship such that schools with more points earned have higher rated teachers. Overall, there are obviously exceptions, and of course there are outliers, right? So we can see two outliers over there on the left.
Which say what?
And also just something to note, this is a district. We have been looking at state graphs. This is a district. So each dot on here, this is a sample of their school, so you can't figure out which district it is. But each dot is a school.
Is a school.
Each dot is a school. We do have a similar graph at the state level where each dot would be a district. And as it stands now, as you can roll in school view, you roll over the dot. It tells you the name of the district or the school.
Mm-hmm.
And tells you how many effective teachers they have and how the percentage of effective or higher teachers and the percent of points earned.
So each dot is a school.
So right, in this particular.
So what do the two outliers say? I'm trying to figure out exactly what they say.
So this is something that we have really tried to talk with superintendents about. For us, this is just high level. So what it says from a numbers perspective is that we have two schools that have either 40% or nearly 80% of points earned on SPF. However, they have according to what they've reported to us, almost zero effective or higher teachers. So for us, in terms of monitoring us, this graph is a great flag, right? These outlier schools or alternatively outlier districts, you know, to follow up with them, what is going on there? Is this a reflection of your teacher pool? Is this a reflection of your evaluation system and your really rigorous, you know, bar for evaluation? Or is this, as is often the case, a function of the data that you submitted to us? And instead of submitting the ratings that you gave your teachers, you did not submit the ratings. You submitted something else, and so they're included in the denominator, and it comes out this way. So it could be, it's for us, it's a flag, right, as a conversation starter.
So you expect this to occur, and these outliers raise questions.
Correct.
Excuse me, I have a question about what you just said about the data they submitted. Can you explain that, what you mean?
Sure.
And how that might give you apparently seem to be saying a...
Sure, of course. Thank you. Great question.
Maybe not an untrue...
So there are as I mentioned, the 14-15 school year is over. The evaluation cycle is over. Educators received their ratings at the end of the school year. Those ratings are not submitted to CDE until the following, you know, December through March, through the HR collection.
Okay.
And what happens is the teachers and principals, the educators who leave the district, their ratings are not submitted. And for educators who are new to the district or to the district, not so much to the school. If they stay within the district, it's not a problem. But if they're new to the district, they're being submitted in this year's HR collection, but they don't have evaluation ratings from the previous year. So they get submitted with codes so they're included as the teacher pool, but they didn't receive, hopefully they received evaluation ratings, but they were not submitted to us because of the process by which the data are submitted. The other thing that happens occasionally is districts don't, even if they have evaluation ratings, they do not submit them to us. They'll submit kind of zero values. So that.
So far, but will they be required to submit them?
They are required to submit them. They are required to fill out the fields. And what they can do, though, is instead of filling out actual ratings, they can fill out numbers that do not represent ratings. But yes, they are required to submit ratings. And so that is also a flag for us to follow up with them to see if it is, you know, a data issue and if it's a compatibility issue with their...
So when you say numbers, you mean they fill out numbers saying we have this many effective teachers, we have this many partially effective teachers?
They in the HR collection, they submit...
What these numbers are.
Yeah, they submit a row for each teacher, and there are values of 0, 1, like a value of 1, 2, 3, or 4 for ineffective, effective. And instead of submitting a value of 4, let's say they'll submit a value of 10.
Because that's what their rating is. Or because they want to make that teacher
because
look
it's
really
not
great.
Meaningful.
Some districts may try to find a way to just sort of get around the data collection by submitting numbers that don't mean anything so that it essentially takes a zero, you know, it doesn't come out right in our data system. That is a flag for us, and we follow up with those districts to say, we're not seeing this data, doesn't make sense to us. Can you tell us about how you submitted it, and can we help you submit it correctly? Just to be fair, this is all very new to districts, so there is a learning curve about how all of this gets put in and the different standards and, you know, so some of this is just a clean up.
So some
over
of it could
time.
Be very innocent. Okay, I got it.
Keep going. Okay. Okay, so those are a few metrics, a few
That's
samples.
My favorite.
Yes. That's right.
This is right up there.
This is right. Yeah.
Can we just put it in every PowerPoint?
Yeah.
You know what?
It's up in my queue.
I'm putting it over my desk. I think it
right.
Cut it out.
And we joke, but really this is how superintendents felt. That's how they felt during the presentations, which then kind of funnels into, some anxiety. So that's why we feel that it's really important to give them a lot more time to understand the metrics. We're kind of gauging what they need in terms of focus groups from us or office hours, whatever they need to dig into these a little bit more. Because the first time, it's like, what am I looking at? So this is what we showed them. We have received a lot of feedback from them, so we're going to share some of that with you. Just so you know, we are trying to systematically collect feedback through a feedback form, which some districts do participate in, but most of them prefer unofficial feedback. So we receive a lot of calls and emails, and we see them in person.
One-on-one.
Right, they let us know. So we do want you to know that a small minority of superintendents do actually feel that this is the right work. It's not what we hear the most, but we do hear that. They feel comfortable with the information being shared. They just want to make sure that we do it cautiously. And specifically, they felt that the metrics were good conversation starters, particularly around the alignment between teacher performance and student performance. And they also felt that these would be particularly useful for smaller districts who don't have capacity to run their analyses.
How did they feel about the 50% of responsibility for teachers on the test, the correlation? Yeah. How did they feel about that?
Dr. Flores, this particular feedback was very specific to the metrics, so we didn't get a lot of feedback there. On the actual requirements in the law. We have other mechanisms for that, and
which
that's
you will
sort
be
of
doing.
A. Well, excuse me?
Will you be doing that? Because I've heard from them that it's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We hear across the gamut on that as well. And so, one measure of that is when they had the choice, when district superintendents had the choice to either go to zero or stay at 50% or go anywhere in between, we actually had quite a few stick with 50%, even though they didn't have to. And then we had some that went to zero. So I think there's a continuum of feedback on what districts and superintendents feel about the 50% measure.
And I hope they would do it on thinking instead of feeling, because I think, as you said, as you showed that other, that other graph, which is this, and this is how I think many of them have been feeling. Yes. And so we need to give them some time so that
exactly what
they don't feel and they think.
Right. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have received some positive feedback, but the majority of the feedback that we've received come in the form of concerns that we've outlined here. We just want to be really transparent with you about what we're hearing. They feel that, and the concerns really pertain to public reporting. We haven't heard a lot about the metrics themselves, which I'm trying to get feedback on, but right now we're really kind of stuck on public reporting, which we understand. I mean, that's where the fear comes in. And they're really worried that the public accountability is going to provide incentives to inflate ratings rather than evaluating educators honestly and giving them meaningful feedback, which the superintendents feel like they've made a lot of progress on. It's slow progress because it's hard work, but they're making progress on giving feedback and having tough conversations with educators, and they feel like this would undermine that, particularly because they've tried to build this new continuous improvement process and build trust, and they feel like that might undermine the trust with their educators.
Mr. Dell, do you have an opinion on how public the statute would like or requires us to be in terms of distribution?
Mr. Chair, in order to answer that, I'll have to review the statutes and questions against the regulatory requirements.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do have a little extra information on that. We have been working with some of Tony's colleagues on this because this question, and we have it a little bit later, has been brought up around authority. The statute does not talk about the public reporting of these metrics. The rules do. And so what we've started a conversation about with the AG's office, but we don't have a formal, it's a conversation right now, is that the statute clearly gives authority to the State Board of Education to promulgate the rules where you all have said in the past, in 2011, that you did want them publicly reported, but that it's within your authority to either make that determination or change that determination.
Thank you.
Thank you. So yeah, and that your question is exactly what we're hearing from superintendents. What authority do we have? Have we overstepped the authority? And so we have engaged the Attorney General's office to make sure that we haven't. Superintendents are also concerned that the public reporting of the metrics would feed the public narrative of failure in schools and that people wouldn't understand the context and would make inappropriate inferences. So we had a great question about the two outliers on that scatter plot. You know, it's you can jump to a lot of conclusions, and they're worried that people will, and those are we understand those concerns. As in other areas that you're quite aware of, people are always concerned about data confidentiality and the misuse of data. We have a minimum N of 5, which is in State Board of Education rules, which means we cannot report if there aren't at least 5 educators in the group. Some people feel that in small schools and small districts that N is not small enough, or not high enough, rather, and that you would still be able to identify educators, and so they're obviously very concerned about that. And then pertaining to reliability and comparability, knowing that there's quite a bit of variation within and across districts in how their evaluation systems are being implemented, superintendents feel like it doesn't make a lot of sense to put up graphs for their district and other district, and though the way SchoolView works, it doesn't facilitate comparisons, but it doesn't mean that comparisons can't be made, that people couldn't look at them separately and, you know, cut and paste themselves and make some comparisons, and they were worried that those comparisons didn't make sense and also didn't account for the local context. So we are trying, obviously, to avoid these undesirable outcomes while also meeting the intent of the law and the State Board of Education rules. So we're trying to kind of find that balance, which is part of why we're here today. A point that I do want to touch on and gets to what Dr. Flores was asking about. As researchers and representatives and other policy folks, we're always interested in whether our policies are effective, right? And for right or wrong, people are going to look to the educator effectiveness metrics as indicators of success for new evaluation systems because they're going to be out there. It's kind of the easiest data. And we just want to make sure that you guys know, and maybe we can work on making sure other people know that there are other indicators of success that aren't quite readily available. In particular, we have a lot of qualitative data, which I've just summarized here on one slide. It could kind of be its own presentation, but a lot of it indicates that the new evaluation systems are improving teaching and are improving conversations around teaching. And this information is based on surveys of our pilot districts that we have kind of deep relationships with, statewide surveys, focus groups, anecdotal conversations, all of this. And it's not on the slide, but there's a recent report out of the Colorado Education Initiative that did a survey of the state on the measures of student learning, which are the student academic growth side. And they actually found that of the districts that responded, 70% said that they would continue to administer the student growth side of evaluation, even if it wasn't required by legislation. So we thought that was really interesting. It's a really good indication that districts are embarking on this really hard work and they see the value in it. And we just don't want to undermine that, of course. So here's where we are now. We primarily are determining when and how to report publicly. This includes engaging the Attorney General's office, which we've talked about and you asked about. We are also conducting a survey of other states to see what their policies are for public reporting. While we're doing this, we're giving districts additional time to become more familiar with the metrics, knowing that this time will help with their comfort level. And we're also asking them to provide concrete and constructive feedback on any changes they'd like to see to the metrics themselves, not just necessarily the reporting. And we have mapped out some possible options for the future. All of which would require a change to State Board of Education rule. So we could report the metrics to districts as we are now, but not publicly. And this would not prohibit us from using the metrics for our monitoring purposes, which is in statute. We could report only at the district and state level, meaning we would not report the data on individual schools. Relatedly, we could increase the minimum number of educators for a metric to be displayed. And then the last option may not require rule change, but that is to only report one metric per shell reporting category. So I gave two examples of ways that we could look at the relationship between educator performance and student performance. You get different information from each one. That's why we've done it two ways, but maybe we could just pick one. And doing that, we could pare down our suite of metrics. So these are some actions we have come up with. We'd love any feedback that you have on them or any other ideas. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Dr. Schroeder.
I'm not entirely sure this is a question, but I'm just remembering the incident in California where teachers' names were published along with the students' scores. So that, to me, is one extreme that's never been on the table in Colorado that we would do that. Now we're talking about at what level is it useful in terms of public reporting, and I'm thinking here about families as well as the general public, and finding that sweet spot that says, yes, the district is evaluating its teachers. Yes, they are having the conversations. There's some level of agreement. In other words, there might be some qualitative reporting that we should expand on prior to a lot of the quantitative in order to give assurances that the educator effectiveness efforts are underway. I think we can spend a lifetime arguing about whether growth in assessments should be 1% or 99%. The reality is there tends to be a pretty high correlation between a lot of growth and a high evaluation, and the opposite is also true. Just about every principal will tell you that. So I don't know if it's one worth spending a ton of time believing that there is a magic spot there. But I don't think that's the important part. I think what the intent of 191 was to have important conversations and to have assurances. And it's in the reporting that we're trying to get to the assurances part. But I want us to maybe think about qualitative reporting maybe at the district and school level so that parents know that these conversations are going on. There's some other things that could be done, but I don't want to open that can of worm right now to give some assurances. But I'd like to hear from the superintendents and principals what sorts of things in that direction might give them a little more comfort. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I worry about a little bit is we're just embarking on this. You know, we're learning stuff from other states and other school districts, but we don't need a big hammer at this point, I don't think. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was not
it's quite all right. Any other any questions or comments? Yes, Ms. Rankin.
Dr. Wilkenfeld, I know how difficult this was out in the Western Slope when you presented this. I thought it was extremely interesting, but I think the more we come forth and explain what's going on like you did today, I think the better it is for everyone. I have received some calls from superintendents, and shockingly to me, because I had some preconceived notions, that conversation getting started as to what exactly it is they're looking for has been very beneficial and eye-opening, not just for the superintendents, but for the teachers, too. I understand their concern with making it public, but I think getting that conversation going in a positive way has been extremely helpful, and thank you for your research.
Thank you for that feedback. It's wonderful to hear.
Okay. Any other comments or discussion? Seeing none, thank you very much. I think this is a very important area. And I encourage you to keep moving forward. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Okay. I think we'll try and proceed to school district item 6.01, school district performance and targeting and target setting. Dr. Anthus, are you also in charge here?
Actually,
okay. Let's see. It should be.
Sorry, I'm usually the texter, but since I was presenting,
yeah,
I
it's
wasn't
Alyssa.
Texting.
I'm sorry. She's on her way.
So it might. She's on her way.
Okay. Right. Correct. Is there action required on this item? Do you know?
The next two items are just information.
Okay. We'll probably try and get through this and then take item 11 out of order and then have a lunch break.
for that.
Quite all right.
I'm slow moving, and you were like quick ending.
Skiing?
I wish.
No. I see.
Okay. Nothing good and fun.
We won't inquire further.
Okay, you ready to go?
We are.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So today I'm going to talk with you all about just an information item, try and give you some background information on how the targets are set in the school and district performance frameworks. It is your role to approve those targets every year. We need to think about them for upcoming years' frameworks, but I just want to kind of give you the background information on how we've done them in the past and how we've been thinking about doing them for this coming year. Okay? So I'm going to talk to you about your role, I'm going to share the past practice, and then I'm going to share some possible recommendations for the next iteration of the performance frameworks. So this is your role, as laid out in statute. Focusing on the part that says the state board shall set, reaffirm, or revise as appropriate ambitious yet attainable statewide targets for the measures used to determine the levels of attainment of the performance indicators for the coming academic year. So usually you do this every November. Because we didn't have our new data back in November, it didn't make sense to do that. We've been digging into the new results, trying to understand it. We want to share some of that learning with you today, and then hopefully in March talk to you about approving those targets for next school year. So in the past, how we've done this, the achievement targets were originally set back in 2010 by looking at the norms, at the percentile ranks of schools and districts around the state. And we have those four levels of cut points, the does not meet, approaching, meets and exceeds, and those were set at the 15th, 50th, and 90th percentiles. They were set separately for schools and districts. They were set separately for reading, writing, math, and science. They were set separately for a one-year framework and a three-year framework, and separately for elementary, middle, and high school levels. And then you all affirmed those annually since 2014, but we kept them steady. We never changed the targets because we wanted to be able to see the progress schools and districts were meeting in the system. So even though they were set by a norm, at the beginning they were held steady so everyone could get to a meets rating if we saw improvement everywhere. It wouldn't automatically mean schools were always in the bottom. So this is a little picture of it. We don't need to go into details. You guys just were deep, deep in data. But basically, it's a normative way of setting expectations. This one is, that's middle school achievement. Yes, this is just illustrative. It's from 2014, so it wasn't the actual data used to set targets. But it's just the idea of, you look at the percentile ranks. So then, you know, we also have growth in our frameworks. And the growth targets were set, we used both normative and adequate growth in the frameworks, which means how well did students grow compared to students like them? And then also, was it enough growth to get them to levels of proficiency that we wanted to see them at or to maintain proficiency if they were already there? So, thank you for clarifying that. We're talking about academically like them, so the same score history and the state assessment. So we don't look at demographics. It's really kids that were in the unsatisfactory category at specific scale scores over time are compared to other kids that had that same scale score history on the state assessments. So high-achieving advanced kids were compared to other high-achieving advanced students. So targets were set that, or where the metric was looked at with both normative and adequate in mind, and then the expectations that were set, they were the same for elementary, middle, and high school for all content areas, and those were set with a norm based in mind, again, kind of that 15-50-90. It wasn't quite as exact as it was for achievement, but it was about that normative distribution. And then the post-secondary workforce readiness targets are graduation rate, dropout rates, and ACT. Those were set in a combination of ways. The grad rates were set with some goals in mind that we had set as a state, long-term goals of 80%, and then some normative pieces in between. Dropout rate was set normatively based on where the state was at, and the composite Colorado ACT score was set with expectations from Colorado colleges in mind for those entrance requirements.
Yes.
Could you just clarify that previous slide, previous targets? Was that, so we had, I can't remember when we had, was that CSAP or TCAP? in 2010?
In 2010.
What tests, again, are encompassed in those that period?
Sure. I think in 2010, Mary Craig, we were still on TCAP then, right?
TCAP.
And then moved to TCAP.
So did that adjust then when you said, where's the language that says determining performance at the 15th, 50th, and 90th percentile?
On that one. It was not reset with the switch to TCAP. I think, and Joyce, you looked at it, but the blueprints between the CSAP and TCAP when we made that transition were similar enough that those tests could be considered comparable, and the performance didn't change.
And then with PARC coming in,
exactly.
How did that change?
And that's exactly why we're here talking with you today, because we know it's very different with PARC, don't we?
Okay, thank you.
So where we are now, why we want to make sure we have some time to talk about this more in depth, is that we do have new assessments with new outcomes, with some new metrics that we can look at. It's a time to really rethink our system, especially after holding targets steady for 5 years. It's a really good time to look at what do we want to have for our expectations as a state. Also, we've seen prior to this year some really big gains with our decreases in dropout rate, increases in graduation rate over time, and it may be time that we want to reset and start reaching for another level of expectations with those. And we've been working with our accountability work group for over a year now, talking about revisions to the frameworks and with the technical advisory panel for longitudinal growth, and they have some suggestions for the measures and metrics going forward. So we'll talk about those today, too.
May I ask, how many, test scores are a metric, correct, or a measure, and then graduation rates, dropout rates, how many components are there at the present time?
So in the frameworks at the present time, we've got achievement measures in there, which is just the state test scores. We have growth measures, which looks at the core content areas in English language proficiency, and then for post-secondary workforce readiness, we look at graduation rate, disaggregated graduation rate, dropout rates, and the Colorado Composite ACT score. There's some changes with legislation from last year, adding another PWR metric, and I'll talk about that in a little bit as
Thank
well.
You.
So for overall target setting, one of the recommendations that we've heard loud and clear from the state is that we want to align the school and district targets. At the beginning, I told you the achievement targets were set separately, and that was to compare schools to schools and districts to districts, which makes a lot of sense. The challenge we have is we have a lot of schools and districts that are one and the same in the state, right? One elementary school, one middle school, one high school, same kids, same schools, data should be the same. When the targets were set separately, then you sometimes got mixed messages, where an elementary school would get an approaching rating for reading and the district would get a meets rating, and it was simply because of the norming. So we want to align those targets together, and we'll bring that to you that way. We've heard widespread support across the state for doing that. Another thing, a big overall thing to think about, is the methodology for determining targets. We've mostly done this based on norms, like percentile ranks and then holding those steady. You could do it more of a criterion base, like we did with the ACT for college entrance. You could do that. You could think about that for all metrics for the state assessments as well. I think we just need to figure out how we would set those expectations, but it's a possibility to think about. And then we had a recommendation from the technical advisory panel that if we're using a norm-based system, to think about, instead of the 90th percentile, going to the 85th so that it's symmetrical with the 15th to the 85th. So small detail, but we thought we'd share that. So for the achievement indicator, we've been having a lot of conversations about this, especially around the metric to use. So historically with CMAS and TCAP, CSAP and TCAP, we used the percent of students proficient at advanced at those top two levels. We could do that again using the percent of students that are at benchmark, level 4 or level 5. There's also an option to look at the mean scale score of students. And so there's pros and cons to both of those different metrics. A lot, we've been getting recommendations that a mean scale score makes a lot of sense in that what you see there, you get a better chance of seeing students at all levels of performance are included. And there's less of a focus of just those, we used to call them bubble kids under AYP, the kids right below the cut score that you could push over. So it's more of a focus on all students and where they're working. The other benefit of mean scale score is around data privacy. if you report 100% of your students are at benchmark, then all of a sudden everybody in the community knows every kid's score, right? They're all at benchmark, celebrate that, but it's a privacy issue. If you report mean scale score, as long as you're above minimum, it's really hard. You really can't figure out what an individual student's scale score is. So that's one decision point that we'll have to make. Then determining the target, we'll have to think if we want to do normative target setting or use some criteria. We'll have to look at targets for English language arts, math, and science separately. There's been a recommendation not to include social studies since it will be tested on a rotating basis in the frameworks themselves, but have it be information that could get used in the request to reconsider process. So if districts want to use it as additional evidence, they could bring it forward, but that we wouldn't put it out there since we won't have it for everyone every year. And then we'll want to think about setting targets separately for elementary, middle, and high school. We're not seeing as much of a difference in performance by grade level as we did with the math on the TCAP, for example, but I think we still want to make sure those targets are specific to those grade levels. In terms of growth, we have a recommendation both from the Accountability Workgroup and the Technical Advisory Panel, and have heard a lot of positive feedback from around the state, to separate those measures of normative growth and adequate growth, the comparative growth to how much growth is enough. How adequate growth is defined currently in the state, it's a much harder target for students that are not currently proficient or at benchmark, and it's a much easier target for students that are already proficient. And so that plays out with different demographics of schools. So we've heard that it would be good to separate those two. Additionally, we think it might make sense to hold on adequate growth for a little bit. This year we clearly can't. You need at least 2 years of the same assessment to determine how much growth is enough to reach certain levels. We'll have 2 years at the end of the summer, but we think it might make sense to wait some time, think about how adequate growth can be used most meaningfully in the performance frameworks. Again, we can think about growth expectations by norms, setting it like the 15th, 50th, 90th, or 85th percentiles, or think about some criteria that we want to use as well, or instead. We'll have targets for English language arts, math, and English language proficiency. We won't have science there. We don't test in consecutive grades for science or for social studies, so it makes measuring growth pretty challenging. And traditionally, we've had the same targets for elementary, middle, and high school level. Probably makes sense to do that. That's another decision point to make. So then for the post-secondary workforce readiness indicators, the Accountability Workgroup had recommended using the completion rate instead of graduation rate. There's a few differences between completion rate and graduation rate. Completion rate includes GED completers, and it also includes students that may get a certificate of completion.
Dr. Schroeder has a question.
So a lot of the measures we're talking about are common measures.
Yep.
And it's been pointed out to me by one of my superintendents that graduation rate is really not a common measure.
Mm-hmm.
So all of my districts are going through the process of setting graduation guidelines. And so they're struggling with, we want to set really high standards
mm-hmm.
for our community because we believe that that's what we should be doing for kids, is to set very high standards. And then we will be dinged on graduation rates, at least initially, until we know that that's an internalized culture in our community. And there is that concern.
Yep,
and I don't
absolutely.
Know how we're going to address that in our state, but at some point, and I think we need to be sensitive to that in our accountability measures.
Absolutely.
Do we study it, or just exactly how do we look at this in order to not game the system, which is what the risk is.
Absolutely. And that's been an existing challenge that we've heard, too, because before grad guidelines were passed, everybody had
right.
their own.
It's just a topic.
Yes.
It's a more
it's
significant
timely.
Topic of conversation right now.
Absolutely.
As the school districts work with their communities to see what are the best expectations for kids.
So there's a few things we can think about doing with that. One, we can think about the weighting of the grad rate indicator and how much that should be weighed in the frameworks, and that's something we'll talk with all of you about. Another thing is we can think of some checks and balances in the system. We could add in something around what your requirements are, or we can think about some other indicators we've been talking about, college credit completion before graduation. There's some other ways to balance it out as well in there, so I think that's a really good conversation that we can all have as we move forward.
Dr. Flores?
I think it's important to have high standards, certainly. But for some kids, if we set standards at such a level that we don't get kids that graduate, we really do have a life and death situation for our student population in some districts. So we want to have, we really do want to have high standards. We don't want to think of kids not working, you know, hard to achieve those high standards, but we don't want to have them so high that we just forget about a large population of our kids who are, if we set the standards too high, and they'll never get it. And we know that a high school diploma is so important now for just getting a job digging ditches. So we have to remember that.
Absolutely.
Keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
And also, can I mean, we're going and saying we're going to talk about this. I mean, I think this is so important, and we kind of bring it up. But I think this is worthy of possibly sitting down, actually sitting down for a day and just working on and thinking about this and maybe having more input from the department and maybe from outside sources where we bring in experts to really think over this. I mean, I think it's that time. We go over it, but we really need to get down to deeper understanding, I think, all of us.
I think the Commissioner Crandall's task for all of us has been trying to think about where we want to be, where we want the state to be in the future in 5 years, and these are the kinds of things. These last two reports are things that are certainly going to be critical elements, and we're going to have to devote more time to them in a more deliberative basis. And I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to get that done as the year progresses. Dr. Shuffle, did you have a comment?
I was just going to comment on when we have high school graduation requirements and everything on the list, but two is a standardized test, and schools are trying to, quote, set high standards. We have to look at the implications of districts that will use largely standardized tests, you know, to as a gate to exit from high school. And we know that those tests load heavily on language, and we know that we have lots of ELL kids and others that struggle with language. And so we have to think about whether or not standardized testing is a proxy for content knowledge and the kind of maturity we expect students to be experiencing during their 4 years in high school. So
yeah,
it is a broader discussion.
Really,
yeah. It's a broader discussion.
Conversations at the local level exactly regarding this, and what are some of the things that their kids really engage in that would be meaningful to them. They're not all tests. I mean, that's the good news about our new graduation.
My concern is that the districts don't have to choose one of the two options that are not standardized tests. I mean,
right.
Districts can choose five things on that menu, two things, depending on their resources, and many of the districts don't have resources to provide a lot of good options, and that's my concern.
I was thinking of making a similar comment, and the board labored long and hard, and it was certainly a difficult decision to try and provide as much flexibility in those graduation standards as possible. I'm not sure we necessarily provided enough flexibility, but we certainly reached consensus on it, and I wouldn't want to see any of that undone by essentially changing the rating system to remove any of that flexibility that we did provide. Okay. Go ahead, Ms.
Thank
Pearson.
You.
Yes, Dr.
I
Shovel.
Just have one more question that's kind of a broad question. We talked about this once several meetings ago, the idea that when we're determining performance at these percentile levels, right, you can almost make it a zero-sum game where you're constantly moving the mean. So you're always going to have some students in the lower quartile and upper quartile. Just move the mean around, right? But we haven't done that, right?
Yeah,
you said
exactly.
We've held it steady
exactly
with those how we've defined those targets, right?
Exactly.
But I mean, is that when we compare our data with other states or even other countries, Do you have a sense of, I've never seen that explicated in the data, which would be a really important way to interpret it, because if some are moving the mean around and some are not, then it's not apples to apples. So can you comment on that? And is there a point at which you do move the mean, and do we know that? I mean, I just talked to, there's just a lot of detail implicit in these ratings and the buckets, which are the labels of where kids fall. Can you speak to that kind of broad question?
I mean, I think broadly, comparing states' accountability systems is never apples to apples. I think there's so many different decisions. I mean, even with AYP, when it was that prescriptive with federal law, you still couldn't compare a state to a state and what that really meant. I think we could do some more research to see if we see the impact of changing, renorming every year, ratcheting up your targets every year, has an impact. I think that would be a really interesting thing to look into.
Because I think we're getting ready to lower the mean because of the huge gaps that PARC has really created that artifact.
I think it depends on how you all want to set the targets. I think we could say we want to set targets again at 1550, 85, or 1550, 90 based on the new assessment results and then hold those for a little bit. I've heard some people are suggesting we keep the exact same percent proficient in advance targets that we had previously for the new assessments. I think then you're going to see lots and lots of schools and districts at those lower levels.
But are we creating the conditions such that only a certain percentage of kids can fall in each bucket?
If we norm the cut points, we would norm it so a certain percentage of schools or districts fell in those cut points. If you set them on a normative basis. If you set it by criterion and say, this is our expectation for the state right now, we think it's sufficient for 70% of kids in a school to be at benchmark or have this mean scale score, whatever we decide we want to do. Then you set it on that criterion. My hunch is that based on the criterion we may set, there'd be probably more in the lower levels than if you set it normatively.
And we're doing a combination of those two, as I understand it. Is that right?
Right now. Right now, what happened with 2010 with those targets, they were mostly all normatively set and held. There was a few with ACT and with grad rate that were criterion referenced.
So as we discuss this, we're thinking through all those issues.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that we need to make sure we understand all those issues because they have huge implications for the buckets that districts end up in and why they are there. Because they're trying to get out of the lower buckets.
Exactly. And then there's another level. This is where it gets complicated. I'm sorry, you guys, but I'm glad you want to dig into it. These are talking about the cut points for the individual measures, so for achievement and for growth and graduation rate. At the end, the way the system has worked, that's all rolled up into points. And then there's been another set of cut points for those overall points for the levels that the schools and the districts get assigned to for their ratings. And that's another decision point. That we'll need to make at some point, too. You'll need to think about, do you want to set it so a certain percent is in turnaround, or do you want to set it normatively that if you're below this percentage of points earned, you're in turnaround? So that's a longer discussion. I think maybe doing a study session or something for those interested, we could dig in to that conversation
some more.
Huge
implications for how we're using the data.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So quickly back to the post-secondary workforce readiness, just so you know, there had been recommendations to use completion rate instead of grad rate. That's a little bit different. Since that recommendation was made, there's been some changes. Part of that recommendation came from the GED cut scores. You guys had heard that before, had been raised to a higher level of expectations. Since then, those GED cut scores, I believe, have been lowered. So I think we're going to want to be really careful about looking at completion rate. It may be an and, like another additional measure to use. We use it already for the alternative education campuses, but we may want to think about using that for all schools.
Is that a law? I mean, how did we get to the point where we couldn't use GED? Is that a federal?
The feds traditionally or historically have said only grad rate, we're not taking completion rate.
Is that law still in place?
It still says graduation explicitly in ESSA. We'll have to see how they interpret that and if they hold to that interpretation now that there's more flexibility with state accountability. So that's a piece. I think regardless, I think we want to look at the grad rate and dropout rate data and see where that's gone over time if you want to adjust those expectations for the state. We'll have to, we won't be able to do it this spring, but we'll need to in 2017 look at the cut scores for the new 11th grade for SAT. Assessment, and we'll have to set targets for the new 10th grade PSAT, and we'll have to discuss if we want to include that next fall after the first year of use. And finally, we'll need to set targets for that new matriculation measure, which is the one that came from House Bill 15-1170. Last session, that says that looks at the percentage of students that the year after they graduate are enrolled in either a CTE program, two-year college, or four-year college. So we're working with higher ed to get that data pulled together so we can look at it and propose some cut points to you.
Can we get that for out-of-state?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's what we're working.
Remediation for out-state, but we can't get
out-of-state. Sorry. We'll get it for in-state colleges and colleges that participate in the National Clearinghouse data. So there will be colleges across the country that, and students who go to those colleges whose data we will not have. So it's not 100% complete data set.
So then schools will be trying to keep track of their graduates.
Yes, it's going to be a little bit challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why we want to get the data. We want to get it out to districts so they can see it. They can start evaluating the quality of it. See how much that indicator, again, should be weighted, how much you want to put that in the frameworks. To touch on Every Student Succeeds Act, because we want to make sure we're as integrated as possible, as long as it makes sense for our state. ESSA requires long-term goals and then interim measures of progress. So those interim measures are probably what we would want to align or have our proposed for our cut scores. Actually, sorry, let me say that again. Our cut scores are what we would send to the feds for the interim measures of progress, and then we'll want to discuss what our long-term goals are. The Secretary of Education is limited on prescribing the specific long-term goals or measures of interim progress, so I think we can set what makes sense to us here, with the board, and then send it to them so it's in alignment with what makes sense for Colorado. And so next steps, we're going to do some more data analysis on those new measures, like the matriculation rate. The percentile rankings and having that conversation. We are, just today, actually yesterday, districts can now access reports with their percentile rankings on our website, and I've got sample reports if you all would like to see those for you. So they can start getting used to where they are in terms of percentile ranks using the mean scale score. So we're just trying to build capacity in the districts to understand some of the data. We would love to have more conversations with you all. If you would like to do that, we could set up a study session time around that and provide more clarification. It would be helpful for schools and districts if we can set targets this spring. Next meeting might be a little bit too early. We are trying to get them informational reports out this spring with the data that came from 2015 so they can kind of get a sense of where they would look and what the new frameworks might look like for them. If we could have those cut scores in them so they can see where they fall, that would be really helpful for them. But these are heavy topics, and they require, or they warrant a lot of good discussion, and so I don't know that we want to rush it for that purpose. So, again, that's a good conversation for us all to have together. So, that's the big overview. What other questions do you all have?
Additional questions from members of the board? Seeing none?
Well, yeah.
Yes, oh, yeah, yes, okay, Ms. Graff.
Sorry. I am sorry. I guess... We've mentioned, we haven't gone there real deeply yet, about the school's currently on the clock.
Mm-hmm.
How we're going to start that, how that intertwines.
Absolutely.
Here, and then in light of state statute that's, I would call it still a little in flux about where we're going to be at a certain point on the calendar. So I'm curious if you guys have had a chance to, you folks have had a chance to talk about that a little bit. What are some possibilities where we can, if we can, where does everything come together at the fork of the road?
Yep.
That's what's on my mind right now with all of this. And considering that we have to talk about this implementation of ESSA, and there's timelines kind of inherent in that as well, some of which we don't know yet. So any thoughts on that?
We'll talk a little bit more this afternoon about the accountability clock and where we're at with that, but yeah, I think you're seeing exactly that alignment challenge, that when we reset these targets and we really think about the distribution, the targets for the overall ratings, you could think about setting them in a way that schools that have worked really hard and have come off the clock end up back on. You could do it so that you don't have anybody new percentages go back on, but I've been struggling with it and talking about it a lot, because it's something we're really going to have to wrestle with. You could set them in a way that nobody's on the clock anymore, and then so there's a lot of options that are available.
5%.
Yes, and then you've got the lowest 5% for ESSA, and how to think about that too. So, Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, but I think there's a lot of opportunity for alignment, and more this time than previously in most aspects of ESSA accountability, that we can use what we already have for the state system. It aligns really well. What we already have or what where we want to go looks like it fits right into the law. So there's some areas that we may need to work on and adjust on, push back on a little bit. But
yes.
So are you saying we need to vote on something in March? You said best by March 16.
I would love it if you all would be willing to or want to set some tentative targets so we could get reports to schools and districts in the spring. We don't have to because we don't have a statutory requirement to get those reports out, or we could provide those reports without an indication of the performance. But it would be helpful for them to know what those targets are. I think it's state board rule that says targets should be set in November. We clearly couldn't do that because we didn't have new data at that point. So I think there's pros and cons to all of it. Right?
And so by that time, we have to decide if we're taking a normative or a criterion approach or a combined approach.
I think
and look at each bucket with each cut score and look at how many schools fall in each one and what the implications are for the five-year clock and all of that.
We don't need to set those overall targets by March for the reports to be helpful for the districts. I think it's just looking at the cut scores for achievement and for growth and PWR. If we could do the detail pieces and not the big overall piece of ratings or distribution of ratings, if we could do those details sooner than later would be really helpful. But if you all aren't ready, that's totally fine, and we can send out reports without those indicators of performance levels. They can get their information that way, and then we'll just need to have those targets set by the fall for when we release the school and district performance frameworks.
So maybe I'll just ask others to let's think through the mechanism of really thinking through all that detail, because there's a lot of implications behind, you know, voting in March on something or determining
absolutely.
Something in March.
It's just next month.
Yeah.
That's just next month.
I know, that's my point.
Soon. Okay, any other questions or comments? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. I appreciate it. All right, why don't we at this time take a recess for lunch, and we'll plan on 30 minutes. You want more than 30 minutes? 45?
No. 30. I would like to go home.
30, okay. All right, we'll try 30 minutes, and does anybody see a need for an executive session at this point? Anything you want to tell us, Mr. Dill, or are we up to date on everything?
That actually might be advisable at this point.
Okay. Ms. Birdsell, if you wouldn't mind.
Executive session has been noticed for today's State Board meeting in conformance with 246-402-3A CRS to receive legal advice on specific legal questions pursuant to 246-402-3A Roman numeral 2 CRS and matters required to be kept confidential by federal law, rules, or state statute pursuant to 246-402-3A Roman numeral 3 CRS.
Okay. Is there a motion for executive session? Dr. Schroeder moves. Any second? Yes, Ms. Masnick seconds. Is there objection to the adoption of that motion? Seeing none, that motion is unanimously adopted. Thank you very much. We'll stand at recess for at least 30 minutes.